You are listening to a free podcast of The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. To support the show and receive nearly an hour extra material daily, become a member today at majority.fm. Resistance is futile.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. It's time to look in the mirror, America. Do you like what you see?
I keep referring to Obama as the magic Negro.
Do you like what you see now?
Well, suck on this.
It's just a mirror, America.
Shared sacrifice by everybody.
What could it do to you except reflect your image?
I did nothing wrong at the Minneapolis airport.
The Majority Report.
Far more credible to me than PBS.
And Frontline.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
And I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Thursday, May 3rd, 2012. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Today on the program, author, professor, writer Eric Alterman on his most recent book, The Cause, The Fight for American Liberalism from Franklin Roosevelt to Barack Obama. Also on the program today, go the rich people. Go the top 0.01%. Nobody loves us, so we're going to leave the country. Also on the program, kudos to the DEA for leaving a 23-year-old grad student in a cell for 5 days with no food or water. Fracking, worse than you imagine. Also, an EPA official once again gets booted from this administration in their never-ending quest to appease Fox News. And congratulations to Tampa. You'll be able to have guns out in front of your RNC. No squirt guns, but actual real guns. More on that as the program continues. Before we get to Eric Alterman, over the past couple of weeks, we've seen Nancy Pelosi come out, edge out, and say that she would support the Simpson-Bowles plan for deficit reduction. Couple of things about this. One, in the past, Nancy Pelosi has made it clear that she would never sign on to the Simpson-Bowles plan because of its cuts to Medicare and Social Security. Two, there is no Simpson-Bowles plan. There's a letter written by two guys, one named Simpson, one named Bowles. There was no commission. No commission plan, because there was a commission, but you needed 14 out of 18 votes for it to produce a plan. They couldn't get those 14 votes, so there is no plan. There is no commission. It's just two guys. One, a foe of Social Security, longtime Republican foe of Social Security, and two, a longtime corporatist Democrat foe of Social Security. And lately, Nancy Pelosi has been coming out saying that she would support it. It was a little bit obtuse. And this has been taken by people who work on behalf of protecting Social Security as perhaps a ploy by Nancy Pelosi to seem more reasonable, to appeal to the polling, which shows that Democratic voters want to see their leaders compromise, to appeal to the corporate media that that claims that we must have some type of bipartisan consensus, and it's done with the full knowledge that Republicans will never agree to the plan outlined by the Simpson-Bowles letter that they sent, because it calls for tax increases. Well, today, and I wish I had known, but of course there was no way for me to know, Russ Feingold came out with a very strong statement and letter basically chastising Nancy Pelosi. I will read. For years, wealthy individual and corporate interests have used the influence they've bought in Washington to make privatizing Medicare, Medicaid, and Social Security and getting their hands on the resources devoted to those programs a national priority. Recently, Democratic Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi has signaled a disturbing potential willingness to adopt a plan that could slash these benefits, and it follows a pattern. Too many House Democrats, including Steny Hoyer, are already on board. Steny Hoyer, of course, that corporatist number two in the Democratic caucus. Cuts to Medicare, Medicaid, and Social Security benefits are unacceptable, and they shouldn't be put on the table by Democrats for any reason, including cynical political ones. Leader Pelosi must stand up for these crucial programs. Good for Progressives United and Senator Russ Feingold. I hope Nancy Pelosi listens. She may have a sense that this will never come to fruition, but there's no point in putting it on the table. As I think our next guest, Eric Alterman, will reiterate, author of The Cause, The Fight for American Liberalism, From Franklin Roosevelt to Barack Obama. We'll be right back after this. We are back on the Majority Report. I am Sam Cedar, and folks, I cannot tell you how happy I am to welcome back to the program frequent Majority Report guest, old version, new version, author of 9 books. The latest, The Cause, The Fight for American Liberalism, From Franklin Roosevelt to Barack Obama, but also author of Kabuki Democracy, Why We're Liberals, the national bestsellers, What Liberal Media, the book on Bush, When Presidents Lie, A History of Official Deception and Its Consequences, Sound and Fury, The Making of the Punditocracy, must reads. There's more, of course. He also is a writer for The Daily Beast. Cap, he is a professor. Welcome to the program, Dr. Eric Alterman.
Thank you, Sam. You know what, Sam? Yeah. I got an email not long ago from Mark Green complaining that on my Wikipedia page and ericalterman.com, it doesn't list the name of my co-author on the book on Bush. So I want to make sure that everyone knows that the co-author of the book on Bush was Mark Green.
Yes, would you like to talk about that experience?
When I go, I could go today, a bus could hit me. I want to be in good with, you know, the ungendered, non-person being upstairs.
I understand. All right, well, that's very good. You're showing a tremendous amount of humanity, and of course, I'm sure everyone knows that if there is a deity, they are certainly concerned about Mark Green's Wikipedia page.
No, it's my Wikipedia page.
Well,
I've never seen Mark Green's Wikipedia page. Anyway, the book, it's great.
Yes.
It's a history of post-war liberalism from the death of Franklin Roosevelt until today, and it's very critical. It's not at all boosterish, and it focuses on people, not politics, but also culture, like Bruce Springsteen and Oliver Stone and whatever. Okay, now.
Yeah,
ahead.
No, this is, I'm holding it here in my hand. I have to be honest, I'm barely a fifth of the way through the book. It is, this is something that's, I think I'm going to be able to read over the course of the summer. It's also a beautiful cover, I got to say.
And, yeah, no, this is a book that should totally be judged by its cover.
but it really is. It's so far I'm enjoying it incredibly. It is a history book of people. It is a history book of political philosophy, and it is also a sort of a roadmap. And so let me ask you a couple of questions, if I may, that are addressed in the book and I imagine will be addressed in the book. So, I mean, first off, over the years, I know when I think back of our conversations that you and I have had and also our conversations that we've had with Janine in the past, Janine Garofalo, my former host on the Majority Report 1. Liberalism, you have always very strongly felt that we must continue to use this word liberal. Tell us how do you define liberalism?
Oh boy, that's a long answer.
Well, this is why we've got plenty of time for you. I've set aside my entire day.
Well, I have to eat lunch at some point. So,
well, I already teased that you'd be eating during the interview. So feel free.
Anyway, so here's the answer. I answer this question a lot, so I know the answer to this question. There have been three phases, historically speaking, of liberalism, and they've built on one another. The first phase was the founding of classical liberalism, which it to some degree coincides with the founding of the United States of America. The great Enlightenment philosophers, they came to the view in the late 1600s, early 1700s, that kings and popes were not the true authorities on how one was to live. One had freedom of thought, one had freedom of religion, one had freedom of association, one had freedom of expression. And using these senses and freedoms, people could join together to direct their own lives without accepting instructions from up above. This is the core of liberalism, that people have reason, and reason will guide you to the best solution. It's Margaret Thatcher was a liberal. Ronald Reagan was a liberal, although he didn't always talk like a liberal. And of course, liberals are liberals. This is classical liberalism, and this is what liberal means. It continues to mean in most European countries. But in the end of the 19th century, it became clear that classical liberalism was a theoretical matter for most people, because big business had gotten so strong following the Industrial Revolution and the massive immigration into this country that people were working 16 hours a day for subsistence wages. They couldn't send their kids to school, and all of these freedoms were not exercisable. So they needed ways to combine to demand their freedom from these institutions. Began with labor unions and other forms of association, and eventually Franklin Roosevelt, during the New Deal, brought the government to their side. So people began to look to the federal government to support them in their ability to demand the actual freedoms that classical liberals promised. And that was what the New Deal was about. It was about using the federal government to even up the score between individuals and the great forces in the economy that controlled their lives. That was a great thing from an electoral standpoint. Roosevelt and Truman won 5 elections in a row. The Democrats won, I think, 12 out of 13 elections in a row. In the 1960s, however, civil rights... the dark side of the New Deal is that it didn't apply to black people in the South. The only way that Roosevelt could get the support of Southern Democrats that he needed was to allow them to continue to deny full human rights and civil rights to blacks. And Eleanor Roosevelt was always on his case about this, and he kept telling her, this is the only way I can help anyone, and they were both right. So by the early 1960s, liberals, the civil rights movement had become strong enough to force liberals to pay attention to it. And So liberalism embraced civil rights, and then after it embraced civil rights, it other groups said, hey, what about us? And so it embraced women's rights and gay rights and Hispanic rights and American Indian rights and handicapped rights. And it, at the same time it did this, the economy, which had been growing and supporting the expansion of the pie for everybody, began to shrink. So two things happened at the same time. One is that liberals began to fight amongst themselves for the spoils of what the federal government could offer and what liberalism had to offer. And second, they inspired enormous resentment on the part of the people, primarily the white working class, that felt they weren't included among these special groups and were being asked to make sacrifices for things they hadn't done wrong. So the social period of social and cultural liberalism, which is the period we're still in, has been a very fraught period politically, even though I don't think you can say you're a liberal if you don't support full equal rights for everyone. Liberals haven't figured out how to manage the political problem.
Let me go back over this because, you know, there's a pattern here. I mean, you have this classical liberalism, which purports to provide some form of social emancipation for people. We as individuals and common folk, as it were, non-royalty, non-popes, I guess, we have the ability.
Non-dictatorship.
Non-dictatorships.
I mean, we're not Marxists either.
Right. But we have we have autonomy. So this is a form of social emancipation. Now, of course, the we is very narrowly defined at that time, just white guys in white wigs. And then the result after a certain period of time is that economic forces, economic institutions begin to curtail the rights of people at that point. Now no longer have to wear the white wigs. They're still a part of it as long as they're still white and of a part of a certain sect of society. We then see the pushback and the cry for more, I guess, even a broader social emancipation, but also allows for economic participation. And then we get this last wave of social emancipation that brings everybody into the onto the playing field, essentially, but the resultant sort of crowdedness, I guess, on that playing field begins to sort of fracture the liberal coalition. I mean, is that basically it right there? I mean, I guess maybe I'm just reiterating what you said, but I'm trying to make up for the fact that I was going to ask you what's the difference between Johnson's liberalism and FDR's liberalism, but I think you've explained it there. One was...
Yeah, well, you did a pretty good job of restating what I said, you know, in a way that makes it in some ways clearer. But a part of the problem is that there are people in this country who are not liberals. And there are people in this country who are resistant to racial equality and gender equality and sexual equality. And yet they are supportive of economic equality. And so, I mean, when liberals said, okay, we're going to have racial integration, and everyone who's been benefiting from the denial of rights to blacks now has to give up the benefits they were getting. And in fact, you're going to have to give up even more than that because blacks have been denied for hundreds of years, and we're going to try and make up for that. Liberalism had no plan for when these people said, you know, I don't really think that's such a great idea. And in fact, I'm willing to defend my way of life with violence, with whatever means necessary. And certainly by not supporting you, you know. And then liberals would say, well, you're a racist if you don't support me. And they would say, fine, I'm a racist, whatever. I have no use for you. And the problem is, from my standpoint, is that the best way to ensure progress for the people who have been excluded is by economic means. And that's also the best political strategy to bring together people under a single, as through class rather than race or gender or sex, to unite them rather than divide them. But people tend to identify ethnically and sexually and whatever. They don't identify by class. And so, number one, when a significant percentage of the country is white, and it's still a significant majority, if you appear to be helping the minorities, then people feel excluded. And number two, it's very hard to get anything close to a majority when people see themselves as divided. I was in New Orleans last week. I had a great time at Jazz Fest, and it was a wonderful moment to see all these different kinds of people coming together and being really nice to each other and hanging out and feeling comfortable. But that is you see that every once in a while in this country, but most of the time people are in their separate enclaves. The internet has actually contributed to this. And they're unable to see their common interests and their future as a collective. And the thing about liberalism that makes it very difficult, there's actually two things that even if everything else were cool, there's two problems with it. One is you need to vote your hopes and not your fears. And it's much easier for politicians to stoke people's fears. And the second thing is liberalism is not that exciting. You know, Ayn Rand is more exciting. Karl Marx is more exciting. Rush Limbaugh is a lot more exciting. He's more fun. I don't actually listen to Rush Limbaugh, but I got the impression he's more fun than NPR is. Because being moderate and thoughtful and recognizing limits and so forth is not thrilling. So liberalism has all kinds of problems on the one hand, but on the other hand, it's really the only form of governance that makes any sense.
And, all right, so let me ask you this. But okay, now I understand and I have a sense of the cleave that basically took place at the end of the 60s, early 70s. You can see it in terms of like the labor movement and, sort of feeling left out of the social emancipation movement in some ways when the Democratic Party became about equal opportunity for women and rights for minorities. When you say that this became a problem, was there any other way to do it? I mean, you know, I understand like the notion that the argument that the best way to serve that we don't look at ourselves in the context of class. And part of the reason I would imagine in the 1960s, people were not looking at themselves in the context of class was because of the so-called Great Compression, where those class lines were less delineated, where we had a very small amount of income disparity in this country, where there was the mass of people, at least, had the opportunity and the feeling of financial security. I'll get a job at this company. It'll take care of me for 30 years. I'll get my pension. My kids will have a better shot at college or at least getting a high paid job, even if they don't go to college. Those distinctions were at a point in American society where that was less relevant. And this was the best opportunity to essentially bring other people into the first class of citizenry. To expand essentially the we that wanted to emancipate themselves. Didn't we have to do that, though?
Yeah, we had to do it. Absolutely. I don't deny that we had to do it, but we could have done it a lot better. I quote Pat Moynihan saying that liberalism has a tendency to overpromise and underperform. And the reason is because liberals, they don't plan for their plans to go wrong. They say, if you oppose me, you're a bad person. You're an immoral person. You're a racist. You're a sexist. You're a heterosexist. You're a genderist. They invent all kinds of words to tell people why they're bad. Instead of recognizing that society is a very complicated organism and government is a very blunt instrument. Ronald Reagan was right about bureaucracy. I mean, all of us who have cell phones and health insurance policies know that. And yet, the most important component of liberalism is to believe that government can improve the lives of people. Our greatest problem for liberals to revive economic liberalism is the fact that only 17% of people believe that the government can do any good. So liberals blew a big chance. And you can blame it on the Vietnam War if you want. Or you can blame it on the fact that a lot of the country didn't want integration in the first place and had to be dragged into it. But liberalism blew a big chance in the 60s and 70s by failing to recognize the fact that their plans were going to screw up and needed to be readjusted. Busing in Boston was a really bad idea, you know, and the people who opposed it, they may have been racist, they may not have. It doesn't really matter. The fact is that it turned people against liberalism. And liberals need to pay a lot of attention to getting things right. And they don't do that because they have a tendency to be morally superior. And if you worked at The Nation, as I do, by the way, you didn't mention that I've been a columnist for The Nation for 20 years. Almost 20 years.
It's almost impossible
to list. But anyway, if you worked at The Nation, you would really understand the problem of liberal self-righteousness.
Well, I'm sure if I worked at the National Review Online, I'd also feel the same way about conservative self-righteousness. I mean, I guess my point is
yeah,
that,
but you see, what conservatives get to say is, we're going to leave you alone and let you live your own life. Whereas what liberals appear to be saying, and it's in part because conservatives have defined them for the past 40 years, is we're going to tell you how to live your own life. And it's a very difficult message to get across.
Well, yes, but I mean, I'm not convinced. I'm still not clear on how this could be avoided. I mean, yes, I can understand what you're saying.
I'll give you an example of how it might have been avoided. I'm in a decided minority on this point, but Hannah Arendt, the German refugee intellectual, wrote an article in Dissent in the early 1950s saying school integration is a mistake. Putting the burden of integration on school children is wrong. Why don't we try marriage laws? Why don't we try miscegenation laws and begin with that? Because these people are volunteering to undertake this struggle, and they're actually hitting the white supremacists exactly where they live. Now, almost nobody I know agrees with this idea. I just saw Calvin Trillin the other night at the Penn Dinner, and he covered the integration of University of, I don't know if it was Mississippi or Georgia, it was one of the very first ones. And he saw all that violence, and he said, no, it had to be this way. But I just think that going after schools and housing patterns threaten people where they live most deeply, and there had to have been ways either to compensate these people better than they were compensated, or find ways that were not so central to their lives that they would literally fight you with guns and knives and explosions.
But Eric,
yet liberals
ask,
felt so self-righteous, self-righteous in their that they wouldn't consider this.
Well, look, the bottom line is, as soon as you say that as soon as women are emancipated and are able to go into the workforce, once they have autonomy over whether or not they're going to have a child, as soon as you say that black people are now going to be able to share in the pie, regardless of the growth of the pie or not, for a moment, let's put that aside. The fact of the matter is, you are taking stuff away from white people and from men. There's no way to avoid that. I mean, it seems to me
when all these programs were devised, the idea was that we could keep growing the pie. I don't like to use growing that way, but that was the idea. The pie could be expanded enough to continue to bring people in. That was the liberal dream. And in fact, what liberals did is they spent so much energy and time fighting with one another about who got what rights that they lost sight of the economic fight, and the conservatives swept in and redefined government to mean rich people don't have to pay taxes. And if there's not enough money, tough luck on poor people. And not only that, elections can be decided by money. So now it's a much, much harder case to make.
Even
if you elect Barack Obama president, he can't deliver because of the power of money in the system. So I think liberals, I mean, look, I got nothing nice to say about the people who've been, you know, running our system and into the ground for the past 30 years. I've written lots of books about them. But liberals took their eye off the ball. The ball is economic. From the standpoint of government, the ball is economic. And the other stuff, the cultural stuff, which I believe in and I share, that's secondary. Andrew Cuomo, who vetoed the millionaire tax but passed gay marriage in New York, should not be a liberal hero.
Yes. I mean, listen, there's a difference between now and 40 years ago. I mean, that's the thing is I tend to agree with you. I think that these corporatist Dems, if you want to call them, or these essentially these midwives to the plutocracy in this country use things like gay marriage as a, you know, and we saw, you know, what was Bill Clinton's first move? He figures he comes in, he tries to liberalize the military, and then he's going to hit us with welfare reform and et cetera, et cetera.
Your history is actually incorrect.
Oh, okay.
The last thing, I was pretty close to the Clinton people back then. The last thing in the world they wanted was to do gay marriage. I mean, to do gays in the military. That was forced on them by conservatives who were looking to upend them and was successfully done. Sam Nunn was messing with them. They wanted to do economics, and they got screwed, and they were just incompetent in handling it. But that's not what they wanted. Oh. All Clinton did was say yes to a question, should gays be allowed to serve open in the military? He didn't make it a campaign play. He didn't make it a big deal. He just answered the question yes, and then that set off this whole chain of events.
Well, let that be a lesson. This is why we're talking to a doctor of history in some respects. So be that as it may, but I agree with you with your point that particularly now social liberalism is far easier than economic liberalism. That we see it used as a mechanism in some ways. I think to distract liberals today. But when we're talking about 40 years ago, my premise is, and my argument is that there was an inevitability that this was going to happen, that you can't really prevent it. I mean, I can see the argument that perhaps you don't want to put the burden on children, but you get rid of miscegenation laws. I don't know how the federal government does that, because those are laws that were basically in the state. But I guess you know the federal government does that, and the implications, they have that fight on the federal level. But nevertheless, it seems to me there was a certain inevitability that there was going to be this pushback. And, you know, you quote to me Moynihan, I can't remember who the blues singer it was that said, you know, I have to, I promise more than I can do to be able to do the things that I can do. You know, the idea of this ever-increasing pie, I don't know that that was even a possibility. I mean, you know, it was quite clear with globalization whether or not this ever-increasing pie, never mind about sustainability, was sort of a myth.
Nobody knew that until, and the very earliest anybody began to understand that was the 1973 war, the Arab-Israeli war, where, you know, oil was cut off. But until the early 70s, remember, there was this period, which I describe in the book, of the end of ideology, which was a book by Daniel Bell, a liberal, and it was widely accepted. John Kenneth Galbraith was saying many of the same things, that we basically had gotten government right, that this was a great form of government. It was responsive. It had room for everybody, but it was responsible. And we just needed to tinker with the economy to get the exact mix so that we could grow into the future forever. There was actually another moment kind of like this under Clinton. But that turned out to be wrong, because in fact, the manufacturing jobs, which had been the escalator for people into the middle class, were disappearing overseas to low-wage countries. And there wasn't anything to be done about that, because we had such an open economy. That was part of our ideology, and it was part of our Cold War strategy to rebuild Europe and Asia. So once that started to happen, and the jobs that the whole thing were that formed the foundation of the political philosophy started disappearing, then things got much uglier than they needed to be, particularly since it took so long to recognize it.
All right. So what do we do now?
Well, my view, and again, I'm not sure how widely shared it is, and also I'm not even sure that my view is so important. It's important for like discussions like this, but again, my book is a history. My book could have been written by a conservative, I like to think, who is open-minded. My view is that we need to find ways to revive faith in government so that we can – you see, now when people vote, they don't really listen to what politicians promise, because they don't think politicians are going to deliver. And so they vote their identities or their fears.
Right.
we need to find ways to get people to believe in what they're voting in, so that the liberal idea of liberal progress and, you know, unity on behalf of the 99% or so, 99.6% really, is meaningful. But the way money works in our system now, and you can see it in the healthcare bill, which was an enormous achievement on the one hand, and on the other hand, so watered down that you can hardly tell it's missing key components it needs to make a real difference in a lot of people's lives. So that when the government delivers, it actually delivers. You know, I was having lunch recently with a friend of mine from Paris. We were talking about the French election, and he was telling me that that if Hollande is elected,
Hollande is the socialist candidate.
Right, that he's going to remake the agreement on European debt, and that's going to upend things. And I said, well, can he really do that? And he looked at me like I was crazy. He says, of course he can do it. It's a parliamentary majority. He can do it. Whereas in this country, if Obama got elected to do something that the banks opposed, he wouldn't get to do it. It doesn't matter. So we need to get a system where it matters. And that means struggling with the power of money in our system.
All right. So, but how do we make, I mean, how does that happen? I mean, are we, you know, I guess what I'm asking is, are we in some type of death spiral here? I mean, because we can't, I don't know if President Obama ever had inclinations to do anything that the banks didn't want or not. It's impossible to know. But by his actions, it certainly appears that there's been no time during his presidency where he has wanted to in any way curtail the power of banks and the power of money. There's a piece that came out today, or I guess it's coming out in the New York magazine, New York Times magazine, Sunday magazine, by Nick Confessor about how money has responded to Obama. And there was one instance in 2009 where Obama is sitting with a group of bankers, and he says, "My administration is the only thing between you and the pitchforks." Now, it seems to me that FDR, when he said this to the bankers, he was using that leverage. In other words, he said, you know, the deal he struck with these people was much more in favor of the people with the pitchforks than the bankers. And in this instance, it's almost as if Obama's saying, like, I'm the only thing between you and the pitchforks. Trust me, I'll get you a better deal. Not just than the pitchforks, but even than one could imagine. And so how do we... what are the processes in which we get somebody who, if there are pitchforks out there, is saying, like, you're going to have to take this, guys, or I'm just going to open the door and these guys are going to come running in?
Well, I don't disagree with anything at all you just said. But the problem is that, first of all, one thing that surprised me that I just misread completely, I thought that banks were a lot weaker going into 2009 than they were. They said, yeah, we caused this mess. We're sorry. We still want everything we always wanted, and we're going to get it. And they got, you know, 85% of it. Now, why did they get 85% of it? I don't think it's because Obama likes bankers. I think it's because he understood that was the power calculation that made sense for him to cave into. Now, you know, he's a weather vane. He's a chameleon. He takes on the color of the jungle that he lives in. That's been his great success all through his life. So the question is, how do you change the color of that jungle? Now, we don't have a movement yet in this country. Maybe if Obama had allowed those 13 million emails if he encouraged them to organize independently, we might have had one. Occupy Wall Street could turn into one, but frankly, it's hard to see how. They not only have a movement, they have the money and the capital and the power and the system. So am I a strategist on how you fight that? I probably have a few suggestions. I have no idea if they're good ones. But I'm just trying to say liberals need to pay a lot more attention to this and need to stop thinking that, you know, the war on women, which I agree there's a war on women, that gay marriage, I agree gays should be allowed to get married. immigration rights. I support immigration rights. But that's not, these are not the fundamental issues. The fundamental issue is the unfairness of the system and the lack of a voice for common people who aren't allowed in. And once we allow them in and redistribute power within the system, if we could figure out how to do that, these other things would largely take care of themselves. So that means what it eventually means is overturning the notion of corporate personhood and money as speech. That's the goal. But what you want to do is you want to reach that goal in ways that help you along the way. So if you're saying, do I support a constitutional amendment redefining instructing the justices that corporations are not people, I support it, but I don't see where the incremental how any incremental victories get you anywhere, because assuming you fail, you haven't won anything. So we need to win victories that actually change things as we build support for that view. It's a very long-term process, but I don't see how it can be avoided.
What are those fights that do that?
Well, we need public financing of elections, first thing. And in order to do that, somebody, some really rich person who doesn't mind, who is also an economic liberal, and that's, by the way, one of the biggest problems we face, the rich people who fund Democratic politicians, you know, they like having a lot of money.
Right.
They like gay marriage and immigrants' rights and women's rights, but they like rich being staying rich, too.
Yes.
But somebody needs to fund a study that can demonstrate to everyday people, and then obviously publicize such a study, how much it costs that we don't fund our elections, that we allow rich people and corporations to fund our elections. Because the price is astronomically higher than it would be, you know, for the few bucks that it would cost to actually fund them. And build from there. That's what I support.
Well, I guess, you know, I'll ask people to go out and find that person. But what else? Publicly financed campaigns, what's another one of those battles that will provide both incremental victories that will basically provide the underpinnings for a larger, broader success?
Well, we need to rejuvenate the labor movement. Richard Kahlenberg has an idea for that, making labor organizing a fundamental civil right. I think that's a pretty good idea. It's got some problems because people think that when you give people rights, you're taking away rights from them. That's that's a legacy of the 60s and 70s. But we need troops, and labor is historically the place we got them, and I don't know where else we can get them.
Right.
We don't have mainline churches anymore, liberal organizations have become sort of money drop boxes.
Right.
So we got to change the conversation. You know, obviously, as you know, Sam, since you've been good enough to have me on so much, I write a lot about the media. We need to challenge the media narrative that treats the kinds of inequality that we live with in this country as a natural phenomenon. They're not natural. They don't exist anywhere else. We're at the very bottom in the OECD in terms of income distribution. We have very low taxes compared to the rest of the OECD. We have very low taxes compared to our own taxes historically. And yet every night you hear about how highly taxed we are. Compared to what? We need a media that feels self-confident enough to correct misinformation that comes from the conservative side, and we don't have one. That's why I write those books.
Exactly. Well, Eric Alterman, author of The Cause, The Fight for American Liberalism, From Franklin Roosevelt to Barack Obama. Of course, we'll put a link on majority.fm to the book. Thank you so much for coming on. And I cannot tell you the depth of appreciation I have. You actually held off from eating lunch throughout this entire interview.
Yeah, I did.
Did you really?
Yeah, really did. As the unknown and unnamed, ungendered being is my witness.
Well,
thank you, Sam. I always enjoy talking to you.
Thanks, Eric. I'll talk to you soon.
Bye.
All right, folks. Always a pleasure. One of my favorite guests on this program. I really am almost, I'm almost disappointed he wasn't eating. I think he's had everything from alcoholic drinks that he has sent back with via the waitress to desserts. I think he's actually had a four-course meal over the course of an interview. And sandwiches. I just go back and I think of all the different things that I know that he's eaten during these interviews. It almost makes me feel sad that he didn't eat them. Folks, one of the suggestions that Eric Alterman had was to change our media. And you can help to do that. If you're also, if you're one of those millionaires or billionaires, you can fund that study he was talking about. But short of doing that, for a far less financial commitment, you can support this program, independent media, which brings you long-form interviews. If you can find a longer interview with Eric Alterman out there, do. If you can find a podcast that interviews Senator Russ Feingold, as we did yesterday, do. By all means, do. If you can find a podcast that goes out live, well, you can find a couple of those to occupy. But I don't know. Were there any other ones that were live there? And, of course, like, you know, there are people who go out and are out there and taking interviews. But I don't know if you can find it anywhere. But you can support this program by becoming a member at Majority.fm. We need your support if you have the means. If you don't, email us at MajorityReporters@gmail.com. We'll work something out. I know that past couple months have seemed to be a very difficult time economically for a lot of people who listen to this program. So if you're going through any type of financial hardship, make sure you email us. You can also support this show by buying your crap that you buy from Amazon through our link. You can buy great coffee, tea, or chocolate, fair trade, organic at justcoffee.coop. Use the coupon code MAJORITY. You can support our sponsors, buy our merch, give us a good review on iTunes. DonateYourAccount.com/MajorityFM. See you on the flip side, or the better half, as we call it.